Thank you for that wonderful introduction, David. I think we've made some really groundbreaking discoveries into the genetics of sexual conflict in insects, of course. but really, sexual conflict presents an enormous opportunity to study basically the genetic basis of diversity, you know, on this planet. Animals are remarkably diverse in their form and in their shape, and it turns out that looking at sexual conflict is a really an amazing way of getting at it. And I'll explain to you what I mean for a second. Okay, the primary interest in my lab at McGill is actually a field called evolutionary developmental biology. And you can see here, of course, that Evo-Devo is spelled out in all the wonderful forms that I was talking to you about. And it's quite amazing. Some of the discoveries that were made that set the basis of this field are quite amazing. So I'm just going to describe to you some of those discoveries. And it starts with two German scientists, Christiane Nusslund-Volhard and Eric Vischaus, who basically obtained the Nobel Prize for their work in the early 80s. Because they discovered a lot of the genes that control the development of an organism. So when your eyes develop from the embryo to the adult stage, they found a way to screen for those genes and identify them. And it all came, of course, from this small, tiny fruit fly. That was sort of it's an incredibly powerful genetic system. And it was from the fruit fly that they were able to identify these genes. But one of the most amazing things, you might say, well, who cares? Because these are just genes in the fruit fly. But another amazing breakthrough that happened in the early 80s, roughly in 1984, was we discovered that these genes are highly conserved across all animals. So whether you're a jellyfish, an ant, a fruit fly, or a human, you all share a same set of genes that control those structures. And that was sort of incredible, and I'll just take you through some what I call Hollywood experiments that go through that. So here's an example of one of those genes. This is a gene called engrailed, and engrailed basically is a gene that determines what they call segment polarity. So wherever it's expressed in the organism, it tells you that that's the posterior half or the second half. So here, this is basically the head. Where I hope you can see where the arrow is pointing. This is the head of a fruit fly, and then this is the tail on this side. And then as you go through, engrailed is expressed along the future segments of the animal. And where it's expressed is basically that's the posterior half of the segment. And I'll just show you a more. This is actually looking at the expression. So these are, of course, using some cutting-edge molecular techniques to reveal the expression of these genes, where these genes are being turned on. And so we can actually see where, and up close, where engrailed is being turned on. And if you look at a variety of animals, engrailed essentially does very much the same thing. It has a very conserved function. So whether you're looking, now this is that same fruit fly embryo that's been filleted with a pair of forceps, you can fillet it, and you can see engrailed being expressed marking the future segments. But it does that in beetles, in grasshoppers, in crustaceans, and also in vertebrates like zebrafish and mice, and it just goes on. Any animal that we've looked at, engrailed marks basically the future segments and marks where the posterior half of those segments are going to be. Another famous example is, of course, eyes. We all know, as evolutionary biologists, that there's a remarkable diversity of eyes in the animal kingdom. And so, of course, you have the compound eyes of insects, the camera eyes of the vertebrates, and a very close an independent evolution of the camera eye in the mollusks, in cephalopods. And yet they're extremely diverse. They're very different. A compound eye looks nothing like a camera eye. Yet it's the same genes that actually code for eyes in these different animals. Okay? And this is a gene called PAX6 or Eyeless. And this gene is quite remarkable, because you can actually take PAX6 from mice or humans and overexpress it in any part of a fruit fly. So here, for example, this is the wing of a normal fruit fly. And you can overexpress PAX6 in the fruit fly, and you can get an eye to grow on the wing. Okay? You can do it, essentially, in any part of the fruit fly and get eyes to grow. So if you take the mouse or human copy of the PAX6 and overexpress it in the head of a fruit fly, you can get eyes growing on the head of a fruit fly, on the wings of a fruit fly, on the antennae, and on the legs. So it's really remarkable how you can actually take genes from completely different phyla, swap them, and they will do the exact same thing. Okay? And so this led to something in our field. This brings now, we fast forward to now 2012. We asked the question, well, if all animals have these same copies of these genes, and they're actually highly conserved in their function, how can we explain this? How is it that this core set of genes that's conserved in all of these animals give rise to all of this diversity? Okay? And basically, that's the fundamental, what we call, what's been called the Hox paradox, that how can we understand how these same genes give rise to all of this diversity? And this is, in many labs internationally around the world, it is, a major focus of research. Okay. I think one of the major keys to this, or one of the major keys to this mystery, is actually something that the famous Harvard biologist Richard C. Lewontin has been pushing for a long time. And this is this idea. He wrote this book called The Triple Helix: Gene, Organism, and Environment. And basically, what he argues is that we can't just look at genes. Genes don't control everything. Okay? Genes can only work in the context of their environments. Okay? And I just give you an example. Here in the top left scenario, this is an example of complete genetic determinism. So these three things here are environmental factors. And just imagine this is the genetic blueprint, the box. So what this is basically telling you is it doesn't matter what the environment says or does or how it affects, the genetic blueprint will determine what an organism looks like and how it behaves. And that is something that would be complete genetic determinism. On the other hand, here's another scenario where it doesn't matter what the genetic blueprint is, whatever the environment, basically whatever environmental inputs come into this system, that's going to determine, the environment will completely determine what the organism is. Now, neither of those scenarios make too much sense. We know it's not just genes, and we know it's not just the environment. But in fact, it's a really complicated interaction of genes and the environment. Arrows crisscrossing all over, and these complicated interactions of how genes and environments interact to give rise to how organisms look and behave. And in fact, if in the end, if we take into account some sort of noise that occurs, it becomes remarkably complex. And this is what I think the key is. It's trying to solve this mystery here of how genes and the environment interact. The rules that determine this interaction, if we can figure that out, we've solved a major mystery, not only for how animals look, but also for the human species. We will understand a lot about disease and behavior and many different things. Okay, and so what I hope to tell you today is that sexual conflict actually can tell us a lot about putting genes in their proper context. So we learn something about sexual conflict, and sexual conflict will tell us something about this complex interaction. Okay. This is Vienna, where I spent my sabbatical in 2010. My wife and I, who's sitting in the audience, still dream of the days we spent in Vienna on sabbatical before, having all the many different responsibilities. But again, there's something really struck me in Vienna when I was going to visit the Natural History Museum. And that is that the Art Museum and the Natural History Museum are exact copies of each other, and they face each other. So when you walk into the courtyard, on the left you have the, well, depends on which side of the courtyard you walk in, but on the one side you have the Art Museum, and on the other side you have the Natural History Museum. And you know, I appreciated that, but the more I started, you know, it was a chance to really sort of think out of the box during this sabbatical year, and I started to think that that metaphor is really interesting, because one thing I also hope to talk about is this sort of exchange between art and biology, and also a society and biology. Again, lots of ideas in our own society as humans we import into biology, and on the other side, we import ideas from biology into our own thinking as humans. And that will come apparent to you. You might be wondering, what the hell is he talking about? But that's going to come clear at the end of the talk. So while I was on sabbatical, of course, I got to read some things that were completely outside my domain. And this is where things start to interact a little bit. And this is a painting by Diego Rivera, Man Controller of the Universe. And Diego Rivera, I mean, what he's painted here is this idea that man can triumph over several aspects of biology. And I'm only going to focus over one, which, of course, you have man at the center with sort of a phallic hand that's coming out and grabbing an oocyte or an ovarial, some sort of reproductive structure. And so the idea is that, you know, man can control reproduction. And this was one of the, of course, it's very well known that Diego Rivera was a communist, and one of the communist agendas was to actually control reproduction. And so this was man controller of the universe. In response to Diego Rivera, and many of you, of course, who've seen the movie Frida Kahlo, will know that she was, of course, really, you know, engaged intimately with Diego Rivera, and she wouldn't let that one pass. And so she then, in response to man, sort of man creator of the universe, Frida Kahlo basically painted Moses, the nucleus of creation. And it was supposed to then again center the nucleus of creation on the woman. It was the woman where creation comes from. She's the one who's in charge. And of course you can see that in the sense that you have a womb with, of course, a child, and this is supposed to be, important. And of course, in both paintings, you have very famous, caricatures around. So the idea is, of course, this sort of in our consciousness and in our paintings, there is a battle going on between who is controlling reproduction. Is it centered on the male or is it centered on the female? And again, something very interesting. In our pop culture, we have this, of course, too. This is from Time magazine. This, of course, is one of my favorite things. This was a special issue on the science of romance. And, of course, you've got the woman saying, gulp, I think we've got chemistry. And this is something that Dr. Joe Schwartz talked about last week. And the male, of course, says, I feel my evolutionary biology kicking in. And, my wife can relate to this because evolution's always on my brain. Again, in our popular culture, we have depictions, of course, of a very harmonious relationship between man and woman, in this particular drawing. So we have different depictions. We have harmony, we have conflict, we have who's in control. And this, of course, brings us to Charles Darwin. In his famous book, The Descent of Man and Selection in Relation to Sex. And it was here that Darwin proposed his groundbreaking theory of natural selection. And Darwin basically made the observation that members of one sex compete for the opportunity and preferential mating with the opposite sex. So Darwin saw, this idea. He saw that, okay, once males and females got together, this was a very harmonious process. But of course, to get together, there's got to be the females, because they invest so much into their offspring. A female will often, in animals too, will carry the offspring for many months, whereas the male just contributes just a little bit of sperm. And so the parental investment for the females is much larger. And so females will be choosy, as I have here, and males will compete for access to females. But once the males compete for access to females and the females choose the right male, then there's sort of this harmony that's disposed by Darwin. I'll give you some examples of this, of course, is female choosiness. This is the classic example of the peacock. This is the male with his incredibly illustrious his feathers, and then the female who's choosing males with the ones with the biggest fans. Of course, something again that I drive my wife crazy with, of course, this was taken on vacation in Portugal. This was while I was on sabbatical, we'd gone to Portugal, and I risked life and limb to take to take a picture of this peacock hen who was chasing me all around. So the things I do for biology, But it's a very nice example, of course, female choosiness. Okay, this is a major component. And these are, of course, lizards. These are iguanas that combat fiercely over territory so that they can attract the females. And this idea of male-male competition, of course, female choice and male-male competition, these are, again, there's this exchange between art and biology and society and biology. I'll show you a quick video that, of course, is very much inspired by... it just comes up. Very much inspired by this male-male competition. I think that beautifully demonstrates is the fact that, you have this female choice and male-male competition, but the assumption was, of course, that guy who is holding the flower, when he comes to actually approach her, and he's the one who actually gets to her, that there's going to be some sort of harmonious relationship between them. He's the winner. He's the one who will take her home, and she will passively accept the guy who was able to compete with all of these competitors. And of course, this is just something, again, a buck and a doe. Supposedly when he is able to, compete with all his fellow males, ramming them, ramming each other, that they, of course, when they get together, it's some sort of harmonious relationship. And so now this is where something, an interesting shift has happened in our society. And so you can see already this exchange between biology and society. Some parts of Darwinian thinking of male-male competition have gone into our own commercials. And on the other hand, some parts of our own thinking have then been interjected into biology. And so this comes, of course, with the battle of the sexes. And there's a bit of a shift that's happened. And in a lot of Darwin's thinking at the time when he came up with sexual selection, this idea that females are choosy or males compete, basically what's that saying is that the female is a very passive participant in the evolutionary process, in the sexual selection process. She's either sitting back and choosing, or she's letting the males duke it out and they will come to her. And this, in a sense, some people have written that this is maybe this is a very Victorian view of the female. And the idea, of course, is that there's been a philosophical thing, a shift of thinking brought about by the feminist movement to say, well, you know what, maybe the female isn't such a passive player in this whole process. And, sort of the feminist revolution might have injected some ideas into biology. and have led to some another different view of the way of thinking about the role of females in the evolutionary process. And my colleague and my collaborator, Locke Rowe, got together with Jørn Armquist and wrote this book called Sexual Conflict, where they argue that, in fact, females are not passive players in the evolutionary process. They are active players in the evolutionary process. And guess what, guys? There is a war. There is a battle of the sexes between males and females. It's not the simple it's not as simple as just choosing females, or that there is competition between males to get to the female, but there is a what they call an evolutionary arms race. They are battling for top spot. And we'll go into maybe the dynamics of that in a second. I'll give you a few examples of sexual conflict, at least in invertebrates. But sexual conflict, they argue, Rowe and Armquist, that it's basically everywhere. And this is a very curious case. I'm just going to turn on this video while I think I can. Oh, it's not working. It's okay. So basically what these are snails. And these snails, what you can see over here, just on this side over here, these snails actually inject love darts into each other. So they mate with each other. One injects, so they're hermaphroditic, so they have both male and female parts in the same individual. But of course, the male parts of the individual on the top connects with the female parts at the individual at the bottom, and then the individual at the bottom, the male parts of the individual at the bottom connect with the female parts at the individual at the top. And they successfully transfer these what are called spermatophores, these balls of sperm, to each other. And then these balls of sperm, of course, have to make it through the reproductive tract. But something very interesting happens. On their way to inseminating the females, there is another structure, it's called the bursa copula, where it holds the sperm and it digests the sperm. And so what the individuals have to do is that each one of them, when they get close to each other, they inject these love darts into each other. And they, in fact, a lot of individuals die from this. They basically inject these love darts. And the love darts, groundbreaking work actually by one of our former professors at McGill, he's now retired, his name is Professor Ronald Chase, had spent his life actually trying to figure out what's the function of these love darts. And when you inject the love darts, it turns out they have a mucus that basically enhances the chance that the spermatophores actually get to the insemination, they actually get to inseminate the female, and they actually block the way so that the sperm doesn't get digested. Okay? So these are some pretty incredible, aggressive displays. You know, they just, if you see it, it's quite remarkable. They just inject it into each other. Another, of course, spiders are famous for the black widow spider that eats the male. This is another example in spiders where the male comes up to the female and then he sprays a noxious toxin on the female that knocks her out. And when she's knocked out, he basically grabs the female, drags her to his web, he inseminates her until, then she wakes up and then she's... and then, of course, she fights back and she sprays noxious toxin when she's... Again, there's this... It's really a strong... it's really a very aggressive interaction. There are actually these... I could just keep going on with examples. There are bed bugs. Believe it or not, we think of bed bugs as nothing that you would study but, in fact, kill and get rid of. But in bed bugs, they actually have these organs that they pierce very traumatically, they pierce the abdomen of the female and they inject the sperm through the hole that they've pierced. So it's quite a very different way of looking at the process and thinking about this Diego Rivera and Frida Kahlo and basically who's in charge is where we're getting at. So one of the great things about being a professor is that you can. My former postdoc, Abdurrahman Kila, who is on the left, and Locke Rowe, who is actually an author on the book, he's the chair at the University of Toronto. We basically all got together to collaborate and actually looked at sexual conflict in what are called water striders. And this is the organisms I'm going to tell you about today. And here you can see these are organisms that they're insects that spend their entire life on the water surface. It's quite amazing. These insects have been a model system for a long time for studying sexual conflict, for differences between the sexes, for measuring natural selection in the wild. People at MIT have built robots to figure out actually how is it that they're spending their entire life on the water surface. We know a lot about their evolutionary history and their fossil record. And one of the things that we discovered in my lab at McGill is that it's incredibly easy to identify genes in these organisms and to knock them down. And we could knock down not just one gene at the same time, this is what a normal embryo looks like, but we could actually knock down multiple genes at the same time if we wanted to. And so to combine all of this knowledge of sexual conflict and the ability to actually to identify and manipulate genes was a really incredible way to figure out how genes, to place genes in their proper conflict and context, and to understand how they're operating in this sexual conflict. And we can not only do it in like one species, but we could do it across the entire group. So it's an incredibly powerful system. These are, what they normally look like, all these different organisms. And you see them. I mean, for those of you who have spent springs in Montreal and looked down at ponds, all of these things are just swimming on the surface, and you might not take notice. But here's a nice video by the BBC, in fact, showing how they're actually gliding on the water surface. This is a slow-motion movie in colored water. They basically use their second pair of legs as oars, and they just kind of pull, and they use their third pair of legs as rudders to actually move and glide on the water surface. So you can see how they're sort of moving across the water. It's really, quite remarkable. And one of the amazing things that we discovered that, my collaborator, Locke Rowe, has worked on for her almost an entire career is that when you look at this one genus, Rheumatobates, you see that there's a remarkable elaboration of males relative to the females, and they almost look like they're out of space. These are actually the same species. These are the males, right? And these are the females. And what you can see is that the males are geared up to be able to subdue the female. So the water striders, the males here and the females, engage in an evolutionary arms struggle. The male, every time the male evolves some form to subdue the female evolves either some behavior or something to kick the male off. And so it's an incredible battle. And this in this entire genus, if you look, so these are, for example, these are actually the forelimbs. These are the antennae, these are the hind limbs, and these are the third pair of legs here, relative to the female, which is pretty unelaborated. Okay, and this is another example here of the species Rheumatobates ryleyi, where we did most of this work. And let's actually look very carefully at these structures. So this is a female, these are the antennae here that you see, these are the four legs, this is the head, these are the eyes. And when you look at the male, again, the same thing with the eyes and the forearms. These are the antennae. The antennae now have evolved into these remarkable, almost like limbs. They look like they've actually evolved these grasping-like structures where they could grab you and, subdue the female. So what we wanted to know, actually, is how do some of these structures evolve? It's a very interesting problem because these antennae and these are the male antennae, it's the same gene that controls those two antennae. And so the conflict not only ensues between males and female, but they share the same genes. It's the same genes that give rise to the male and the female. So now there's a conflict at the genetic level. The female doesn't want the male to have those elaborated antennae. At the same time, the male doesn't want, wants more and more, and the female wants less and less. And they're tugging at the same genes. And so this conflict gets transcended at the genetic level. So it's a beautiful system to understand how that conflict not only plays out between males and females, but also at the genetic level. And, okay, so here we have, in real life, the males and the females. And we actually collect these in Quebec. We at the Mont Saint-Hilaire, up in the Montérégie. You can find them here very close, too. So these are our neighbors, in fact. You can find them in our backyard. Okay, where does the conflict come from? I'll tell you in a second. Okay, here, this is a male, this is a male now on top of the female. Of course, this is no surprise, the male wants to mate as much as he possibly can, right? He wants to transfer his sperm to as many females as possible. And so what we're looking at here is we're looking at the mating rate at the bottom and fitness on the top. And of course, the male wants to continue mating as much as possible. But this actually comes at a cost to the female. The female doesn't, of course, needs to mate because she wants to transfer her genes to the next generation. But she can't rate too much because it's actually bad for her. And then you might be asking, well, why is it bad for the female to keep mating? For the simple reason that the male is on top of the female. And as long as the male is on top of the female, she's subdued, she can't move, which means that there are predators from the bottom that can come and eat her while she's mating. And I'll show you a video of that in a second. Here's a nice example. You can see here in slow-mo that the male is on top of the female. They're struggling with each other, and I'll talk more about these conflicts. And as they're struggling, you know, to try and sort of make, you know, in their sexual conflict, here comes what they call a back swimmer, an underwater bug that eats the female from the bottom. Okay? So if the female spends too much time mating and the male is on top, then she runs the real risk of getting eaten. And so, of course, the male doesn't care. He's on top. And so he wants to mate as much as possible. The female is always trying to make sure she mates, but not too much. And so she needs to kick the female off, the male off. And so there's obviously a conflict now about the mating rate. Okay, this is where the conflict in these bugs is ensuing. It's about the rate of mating. And here's a nice example, the males of this evolutionary arms race. So the males start elaborating the antennae, anything that can subdue the female, while the female is at the same time evolving. So this is the abdomen of a female, and you see she's evolved this spike. So she evolved that spike to kick the male off when he's on top. So the male is trying to grab on by his antennae. She's trying to kick him off. And then actually in some species, the male have evolved this very curved abdomen. So the spike can't touch the abdomen and so on and so forth. And they just keep evolving. That's what an evolutionary arms race is. Like, I'll evolve this. Oh, yeah? I'm going to evolve that. Oh, yeah? I'm going to evolve this. And then you get these really bizarre-looking structures, and you wonder how this can all happen if it's the same genes that are involved in this conflict. Okay, so we wanted to understand the genetic basis. How do genes get around this conflict? And we really focused on the antennae. And we did something, you know, we needed to figure out, okay, how are these antennae exactly functioning? So we did two things. We did high-speed camera, we took high-speed camera, we videoed these things, in, you know, so we can get slow-mo action. But that actually wasn't enough. So we had to wait until the male just jumped on the female, and we picked them up out of the water, and we threw them in liquid nitrogen. And that way, we actually, like, as you could say, caught them in the action, right? They were caught in the act, so to speak, okay? And so we could actually then reconstruct what each part of the antennae was actually doing in this sexual conflict. And we've got colored three things for you. What we discovered by doing, looking at this high-speed video and actually looking, you know, by like sort of pulling them out and looking at how they were frozen, that they actually have three structures. The hook, painted in blue, a spike, and a pad. And here's a close-up of that hook. That's what the spike looks like. It's actually really thick hairs, okay? And then you look at the pad, and it's a pad-like structure that occurs. And what we discovered, in fact, is when you look very closely, is that the spikes that I showed you, they fit almost perfectly into the back
side of the eyes of the female, right here. So you can see the spikes fit over here to be able to get a good, strong hold on her. Okay? The hooks, on the other hand, when you take a very close look at the hooks, it's quite amazing. They fit, the hooks fit almost perfectly, like a, sort of a hand in a glove, right under the female's eyes, in these grooves that occur right under the female's eyes. And I'll show you in a second, there are two positions. When they shift, there are other grooves that just, you know, lie just underneath the head. And what's amazing about these things is that they've evolved these, what we call buttons for grips, okay? So that they can really grip the female. So when they put it in a groove, there are very strong grips. And we did a very fine detailed analysis of these buttons. And when you actually look at the buttons, it's quite amazing. Here, you can see the buttons. Not only they have, if you when you look, do these SEMs of the buttons, you find that there are these little stripes. You know, they're actually grooved, okay? And if you look even closer, you can see, can you see the striations in the buttons? Those striations create an incredible grip. And we have a little video here, you know. And in fact, okay, that's the important thing, is that those striations go against the pulling direction so that you get that really good grip. Anyway, let's just move on. But the idea is that there's a really strong grip of the buttons that happens. And so here is the male antennae. So this is the male right here with his eyes. These are the antennae that are coming. The spikes, of course, are going into the back of the eyes like a glove. You come around and then you have the hooks on the back of the head. And the pad is designed so it doesn't harm the eye. It kind of just sits right on top of the eye because you don't want the female running around blind, because then it's not a very good thing, right? You wanna conquer, but not so much. So when the male jumps, he jumps in what's called position one. And once he gets his grip, he then, to be able to put his genitalia into the female, he basically readjusts his position into position two. And that's where he readjusts, you know, the hooks over here and, you know, the spikes over here. And this was actually, when we published this paper, it in fact got quite a bit of media attention. And this was described by Ed Wong as Discover Magazine. There's the worst sex you have ever had, pales in comparison to what female water striders have to put up with. Put it this way, you have never been held down by your eyes. What's amazing is, of course, this whole behavioral sequence is quite stereotypic. So it's not something that, you know, every male that jumps on a female behaves differently. It's a very stereotypical type of behavior. And we're actually, of course, with high-speed video, able to exactly dissect this behavior apart, one by one, and in different panels. So, of course, first the male jumps onto the female, grabs her with her antennae, and then basically struggles with her. And then he does something kind of weird. He picks her up, because I'm going to show you a video, and I want you to be able to sort of interpret these different things. How are we doing on time here? We're already almost, okay, so we're going to have to move. So he pulls her back on her back, okay? And then he basically whips with the mid legs like this, and then he flips her back up on her stomach. She's back, then he pulls her back. And then he basically slides in his genitalia, and then once then he lets go, and everything is fine. Okay, and so that's kind of and of course each of the legs gets used in this conflict. And so here's the video. Thank God this is working. Okay, so this is what a normal conflict would look like. So here's the male. He's approaching the female from the back. He jumps on her. You see, he starts yanking with her on the back, and then he starts using his mid-legs to whip her into position so that she can't use her legs to escape. And then they flip somehow back on the stomach. And this is the case, of course, where the male wins. It's actually, in fact, the female puts up an incredibly good fight. Now they're back up on top, and then, you know, the male starts to relax, and then he's going to get ready to put the genitalia in and slide into position two. And it's really the struggle that the female puts up is incredible. This is an example where the male actually wins, but the male only actually wins at best 12% of the time. He doesn't actually win more than 12%. So it's really a strong fight. So what we wanted to do is actually figure out, well, how are the genes that are involved in these antennae, how do they come about? And so what we needed to do is actually describe their development. And what you can see here is when they first start developing, when they first hatch as instars, the male and the female antennae don't actually look all that different. And then as they develop, you can start to see that the male really develops. He starts, you know, starting to look a little different. But then there's a big jump from the last instar to the adult, where most of the characters of the antennae all of a sudden appear during development. And then they become here, you can see what the sort of the differences in adults. So obviously, if we were going to try and find the genes that operate to make these antennae, we would have to look in this, obviously in this part of the development. And that's exactly what we did. And what we did is we actually, at that time, we took them, at that time of development, and we started to basically yank thousands of antennae off of these water striders. So it took my postdoc a long time to, they're tiny little things, right? So they look big here in real life, but and on screen, but they're actually in real life, they're quite tiny. So you pulled thousands of antennae off the males at that precise time in development. We squashed them up, we ground them up, we extracted from them the DNA, and from there we sequenced that DNA to try and get a list of genes that were being active at that particular time. And what we got was this list of genes that came out here. And there was one gene that particularly stood out, which is a gene called distalis, which, again, it's one of those genes that controls limb development in all animals. So if you knock out distalis in mice, you end up with a mouse, an adult mouse that looks like that, if you knock it out early in development. If you knock out in fruit flies, they look like this. In ants, they look like this. In water striders, they look like this. So if it's active early in development in extending the distal part of the limb. And that's why when you knock it out, it's called distalis. So anyway, it was a gene that was really that stood out. And when you looked at the actual genetic sequence, there was a whole chunk of the sequence marked by these dashed lines that was missing from the sequence. That was actually, it was fine in all of these, animals, like even water striders male water striders that didn't have this elaboration, compared to, when you compared it to the Erematobates, there was a whole chunk of sequence missing. And so we said, there's something going on there in this gene. Something interesting is happening. So we knocked it out, because I told you we have the ability to knock out this gene and multiple genes around it. And amazingly, when you knock out this gene here, this is what a normal antennae looks like with the hooks and the spikes. Now, all of a sudden, the hooks and the spikes are almost entirely reduced or completely gone. Here are the spikes. They're missing here. The hook is pretty much gone. And so it was amazing that we could actually find a gene that could knock out precisely the hooks, the spikes, and the pads. And if you, in fact, knocked it out a very strong, so you knock it out strongly, it looks exactly like the female antennae. And so we knew we were onto something. And something very interesting here, this is nothing, this is just to look at here males and females, and wherever you see this black bar, it means that the gene is expressed, which means that this gene is being expressed in both males and females. That means there's some kind of conflict, because the male, it has to make normal antennae in the females, but elaborate the antennae in the males. And so this gene is under intense sexual conflict, okay, pressure from sexual conflict. Anyway, what's amazing is that when we actually started to analyze the individuals, it doesn't affect the female at all. When we knock the gene down in the female, it doesn't actually affect the female in any way. And in fact, it doesn't affect the male at all, except for those tiny appendages, those tiny, the hooks, the spikes, and the pads. But there's a trick to it. We had to knock it down. If we knock it early in development, you get the short limbs. But if you knock it very late in development now, once it's done its major functions, then you get this male with missing the hooks, the spikes, and the pads, but otherwise the male is just fine. And that actually now allowed us to do something very special that you don't get to do, is we actually could knock it down in different degrees. And so here, for example, is what, this is a control male where, there's hardly any effect at all. This is what we call a mild knockout, where you can reduce these structures, the hooks, the spikes, and pads, just a little bit, okay? Then you could knock it down a little more and even more, and then you could even make it look like a female antennae. Okay? And this, the fact that it doesn't affect anything else on the male, allowed us to realize how is it that this gene, in a very graded way, so if you do a severe knock, if you knock it down really harshly, how does the male compete with the female? If you knock it down just a little less, what happens? And so this is exactly what we did. This is a severe knockout. So we knocked out the male. So it wasn't exactly that the male antennae looked like the female, but it was sort of what we call a mild knockout. So look, now we can actually put this in the real context. We can put this guy in the arena and see how he deals with. And here it goes. So this is a severe knockout. Look at this now. So here he jumps on the female. He tries to yank her back, and he can't. And I'll play it again. He keeps actually doing this motion. So let's do this again. Okay, just quickly. He jumps on her. He pulls her back. And he keeps going with the behavioral sequence, right? He's not like everything else is fine. He keeps behaving as if he's got her in her grip, and he can't. What happens if you knock it out just even a little less now? Okay? And what we noticed is that the less you knock it out, the more along the behavioral sequence they can keep going. So here's what we call a mild knockout. Let's check out the mild knockout here. Okay? And here it is. There's the male now struggling with the female on this side, right here. And you see he's got her. He's trying to get her on the back. He doesn't quite have the grip. You know, he's struggling. He can't quite... and she pops out. Right? And so by knocking down, we could actually measure for the first time. This is not something that, you know... Why this is quite groundbreaking is because the gene itself, you can actually... We know what the gene does. Very specifically, we can knock it down to different degrees. We can put the guy, we can put the guys back in the arena, and we can actually see how this gene is actually operating in real life. We actually know what this gene is doing in the proper context of the organism. So now we can go from gene all the way to function, all the way to the fitness. And we haven't had many examples of that in nature. And this amazing sexual conflict, this conflict between males and females, actually allowed us to do that. Another thing that's amazing is that essentially we've revealed something about the evolution of this, because if you actually look at these moderate reductions, when you actually look at different species in the genus, you know, some of these reductions, like this is a species called Rhamnotobates burgothii, and this actually looks like one of the knockdowns. You can imagine that in this evolutionary arms race, you know, the gene distalis was expressed a little more, gave you a little more elaboration, gave you a little more advantage in subduing the female. The female said, yeah, take this. Kicked him off. Okay. The male came back with a stronger elaboration and stronger elaborations until you got the species that looked like I just showed you here, the Rhamnotobates ryleyi. But in fact, there's a whole diversity of elaborations of these antennae. Well, I think, how are we doing on time? I think I have maybe just a few more minutes. It's very interesting. So I'll just do a little more. This is unpublished work I'm just about to talk about, and it's kind of interesting, like, how do these differences start to begin with in the first place? And so what we did is we found something really fun. We bring us back to the buttons. Remember those buttons, right? And so, remember, they give you those extreme grips when you're, like, pulling on the female. And again, I'm just showing you that, again, it's that they pull you in they've got the striations in the opposite direction. So what we noticed, actually, when we were looking at, we would just pull different individuals from wild populations. So we just go out to the stream, we would find the males running around, we would scoop them up, we would bring them back to the lab, and then we would just sort of look, and we say, okay, well, I mean, one thing we noticed is that different individuals actually had different numbers of buttons. Right? So some individuals had 6 buttons, some had 7 buttons, some had 8 buttons, some had 9, some had 10, some had 11, some had 15. And so there's amazing variation in the wild, you know, for actually the numbers of buttons that you have and the kind of grip that you can imagine. And we started characterizing, for example, the percent in the population of the number of buttons they have. And of course, most individuals had 9 buttons, but there was actually a certain number of, you know, it seems like 9 is somehow optimal for getting the grip on the female. And believe it or not, we can actually we're actually able to get at some of the genes involved in this button development. And so we can really see how in nature there's this remarkable amount of variation. And there's a certain optimal number that gives certain individuals, you know, that certain elaboration in terms of numbers of buttons or numbers of the hooks or the spines or the elaborations. Okay, well, what I'll leave you with, I was just searching the internet. So when I type in sexual conflict, it's only, you know, it's interesting. This book just popped out, right? Sexual conflict in humans, which, you know, that's not something I'm going to touch on at all today because that's not my area of expertise. Thank God. but look at this, just remarkable, like this sort of, this description of this book really struck me, you know, given what we've learned from nature. And remember, I told you at the beginning, there's all kinds of ideas that, you know, from biology we've imported into society, and from society we've imported into biology. We see that in art. We see, you know, by paintings of Diego Rivera and Frida Kahlo. We see it in Darwin and his sort of Victorian thinking. And there's this sort of passages of ideas that go back from society to evolution and evolution to society. And so now, when I was reading this, I was quite amazed. Sexual conflict, what happens when the reproductive interests of males and females diverge, occurs in all sexually reproducing species, including humans. The Oxford Handbook of Sexual Conflict in Humans is the first volume to assemble the latest theoretical and empirical work on sexual conflict of humans from the leading scholars in the fields of evolutionary psychology and anthropology. And then they talk about sexual coercion, jealousy, partner violence and killing, the ovulatory cycle, female orgasm, sperm competition. I was just blown away. So thank God I don't have to deal with that. But it's clear that there seems to be another passage now that there was this idea from a shift from feminist thinking into biology, formulating ideas of sexual conflict in animals, now that we're identifying the genes. And now it seems remarkably that there might be another exchange going back and forth. And I'll leave you with that and thank basically all of those funding agencies who made this work possible. Thank you very much.
On such small insects, how is the knockdown of genes achieved?
So,
very carefully, I guess.
Very carefully, yeah. No, I mean, we have, grâce à la Canadian Foundation of Innovation, we've been able to buy, of course, some very precise microscopes with controllable needles that you can actually, with an arm, come and control the flow rate of the injection. So, I mean, there are some really fancy microscopes. Let's just put it that way. Very fine. Steady hands, good cup of coffee, steady hands, and some very fancy microscopes. Put it that way.
Another question. Could this research lead to humans engineering, modifying sexual behavior? I'm not quite sure I can read, but maybe that sounds like a question.
Yeah.
I'm not sure I'm reading this. Could this research lead to humans and human engineering modification of sexual behavior to maybe improve or change our needs, something like this?
Very good question. There's a very strong case for it. I mean, what we're learning here is two things. One is exactly the rules by which genes operate in their natural environment. So you're putting them in a context. What we learn is how these genes function in relation to these conflicts and these environments. And the fact that these same genes occur in humans doesn't mean that we can't learn something very fundamental about these rules and transport them to humans, manipulate them for our own purpose. That's absolutely possible. But, you know, of course, we're a long way away from doing this, but I think we're making good progress.
Then there was one last question. Would muscle strength in men be an example of some of these modifications in primates?
Yeah, so I mean,
there's a lot of strong women out there.
Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, some of the genes, example, you know, like there's a gene called myostatin, so some of you know, and they've actually manipulated these myostatin genes to make those incredibly muscular cattle. It's like, wow, you know? And those are developmental regulatory genes. You find the same genes here and in ants. And one thing I just want to say is that distalis, even though it's a single gene we knock down, it doesn't mean it's the only gene. I mean, essentially, that gene must sit at the top of a hierarchy or cascade of genes. And so I think the future will be to see how distalis is cascading to affect all of these different genes, which would affect some muscle genes, which then, you know, all of these genes are highly conserved, but it's working in a whole group of genes. So, you know, there's lots of work to do. So,
I'd like all of us to give Dr. Abhi another round of applause.